Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Tennis Channel Inside In, the podcast that covers the game you know and love with expert opinion and analysis. We have a great show for you this week. As always, this podcast is streaming on all your podcast platforms, so go to Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts and search Tennis Channel Inside In. On this week's show, we have former top 40 player and current broadcaster Jill Kravis to recap Indian Wells 2024. She was on site for Iga Swiatek and Carlos Alcaraz's triumphs as they both notched their second title in Tennis Paradise. Kravis breaks down how Iga has looked lethal, how Alcaraz outshined Jannik Sinner and then Daniil Medvedev in the final. We break down all the storylines and drama from Indian Wells, and we go into Miami and discuss the early storylines and subplots for the second leg of the Sunshine Double. And then after I speak with Jill Kravis, I am joined by Robin Duda. She is the co-founder and managing director of Racket X. It's a three-day world-class festival covering all the racket sports in the world at Miami, March 24th to 26th. Going on the same time as the Miami Open, so if you're in town for the tennis, check out Racket X as well. We dive into her journey into this space as an innovator, as an entrepreneur, and what's exciting about Racket X and how all these sports can work together and how Racket X can unite a lot of different people, sponsors, investors, fans, and active participants. It's a great episode of Tennis Channel Inside In this week with Jill Kravis and Robin Duda. I'm your host, Mitch Michaels. Let's start the show. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of Tennis Channel Inside In on the Tennis Channel Podcast Network. Mitch Michaels from the Santa Monica Studios, as always, joined by some top-notch guests in the world of tennis. We're in the middle of the Sunshine Double. Indian Wells in the rearview, Miami coming up. A lot to discuss from the tournament in Palm Springs. Joined now by the former Florida Gator National Champion, All-American. And there's a lot of stats for this player, but my favorite might be 45 straight majors played. Just always showed up on time and very professional. Jill Kravis, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
Yeah, it's been a few, it's been a year actually almost since we talked. There's a lot to discuss in the world of tennis, and I want to get your thoughts on Palm Springs and everything that went down there. But we have to start with the somber news at first. Just want to offer my condolences to, you know, the family of Konstantin Koltsov, Arina Sabalenka's boyfriend. He was a professional hockey player for a lot of years. Passed away suddenly. At the age of 42 in Miami. So just want to offer thoughts there. There's no right way to handle what's going on. Sabalenka is going to play at the time of this recording, but Jill, it's just a somber time in the tennis world.
Yeah, it really is. I was shocked actually when I saw the news on social media, but it was, I think shock is the biggest word that I can think of. And I can't even imagine what his family and Arena and the whole team are going through. I can't even imagine trying to wrap your brain around everything that's happened. But I think you said it best. Just our thoughts are with everybody that surrounds them, and just thoughts and prayers with everybody. Yeah.
There's not a right way or a normal way. You know, there's no playbook for this sort of thing. Sabalenka said she's going to play. Finds, you know, it's comforting for her to do that. So it's her right to do that. The only thing I would say is, incidents like this that happened in sports, especially tennis, shows you kind of how tight the community is. It's good to see, and there's nothing good about this tragedy except for the fact that maybe you can see that, you know, the tennis community is really rallying around her and just offering their support as best they can.
Yeah, and that's probably one of the things I love most about sports in general, is that you're always going to have that connection with everybody. And, you know, when something tragic like this happens, you know, they do congregate around and just try and provide that support. I felt it. I know she'll feel it. Many people have felt it. So that community is huge at this time for her.
Certainly is. Again, our supports to Arina Sabalenka, Konstantin Koltsov's family, and everybody involved. We're going to transition as best we can to discuss the fun stuff with Indian Wells and then get to Miami at the end. I know, Jill, this is a tournament that's meant a lot to you. Now, as a broadcaster and kind of experiencing it from the transition, also just what I think somebody in your demographic, in your era, would say too, how much bigger and more prestige this tournament has gained over time. It's always been a big event, but it seems like it's good that these young generation, this young generation of tennis players values Indian Wells. This is a destination on the calendar.
Yeah, I think in different aspects. I think, we spoke to quite a few of the players that had been there 12th, 13th, 14th year time at Indian Wells in a row. And then also, just like you mentioned, the younger generation where maybe it's their second or third year. And just hearing the different perspectives, I think across the board, all the players do feel like, you know, they have that saying, and it's tennis paradise in Indian Wells. And I think everyone definitely feels that. It just has a nice, relaxing feel. I think some of the players that have been around for many years have said they've liked to witness the evolution of how it's changed and how much it's grown, and how much they've sort of set the bar for a lot of other tournaments to copy certain aspects of Indian Wells. So it's nice to see that, because I do feel like they're always trying to make it better for the, not only for the players, but for the fan experience as well, which has been great to see.
It has been. It's, as a fan, talking in that perspective, probably the best tournament. Definitely, I would say, in this part of the world, if you're not going to the majors, go to see Indian Wells. It's always a good time.
Definitely.
You mentioned players that have been there 14, 15, 16 years. You talked to one of them, and it kind of went viral, that Andy Murray interview after he won his first round match, and had a coach, had a moral coach in the crowd.
Yeah, that was amazing, actually, because he was playing on Stadium One. And all of a sudden, before he went to the house interview, he ran over to one of the fans in the crowd and just offered him a towel. And my first thought is like, does he know this person? So I went actually to ask his coach on the sideline. I'm like, who is that? And the coach was like, we have no idea. So I thought, I'm just going to go for it and ask him. And Andy had a great response. He was just like, he has fans everywhere around the world that are always cheering him on and wanting him to do well. But he said this was sort of a different kind of vocalization from this particular fan. He was very, very specific. He kept just screaming out, this is the best I've ever seen you move. This is the best I've ever seen you serve. And just accolades everywhere. And he was like, wow, I can really feel this positive energy in a different way. And it was something that he really enjoyed. And he actually got fired up from it.
Well, there you go. If you can kill Andy Murray with kindness, I think you can kill everybody. But no, it was cool to see. It's nice to see these guys let their guard down, and it helped them in that match too. So that was a very fun moment. The rest of the tournament, there were a lot of highlights, especially that championship weekend, but we saw two repeat champions on the women's side. Iga wins her second title in 3 years. Jill, she looked amazing. It was methodical. It was a dismantling of whatever was in front of her. It was a masterclass by one of the best players, not just obviously in the world right now, but putting a resume up to be a surefire Hall of Famer. But in this specific event, Jill, you saw every weapon, every tool in the toolbox on display, and you saw her gain steam. She did what the great players do. She got better as the event goes along.
She really did. And I actually watched that match on Tennis Channel, the final. And, I went away for like 5 minutes, and all of a sudden I turned around, it was 3-love in the second set already, and she was just on fire. I mean, it was a close first set. I thought Sakkari played really well. And actually, I felt like Sakkari looked very confident, much more confident than in the previous final she had been in Indian Wells. So it was great to see her sort of have that demeanor. But Swiatek just played unbelievable. Even from last year in Cancun, I saw her at the WTA finals, just another level of focus. And I just felt like even her reaction after winning that title just showed the incredible determination that she has. She's just wanting so badly to win that title, but she was so rock solid.
When you're looking at it from, a former player, from the tennis technical side, what do you think, and there's a lot to choose from, obviously, but what's giving the most problems on the other side of the net? Because we see as fans, and we see in the outside, the open stance backhand, how much spin she gets on the forehand, how she always seems to be attacking when she gets her opening, like a shark in the water. But what do you think is, if there was one area that really does cause the most damage and destruction to the other players?
The thing that stands out to me is her speed. She's so fast. She's so low to the ground. And if you just watch her side of the court, it's incredible how the amount of intensity that she has. And the movement from one shot to the next, I mean, I feel like that is why she's able to be so aggressive, because she's so quick off the step from going from one shot to the next, that that allows her to be on top of the ball so fast and to be so aggressive. And just as an opponent, it just, you just feel like you don't have time to breathe. And I think that's one of her biggest assets.
Yeah, you can kind of see players think like, wow, am I playing two players on the other side of the net? What's going on? There's not really a rhyme or reason there. She gave a great interview on the Tennis Channel desk, not just a cheap plug on my perspective, but also learning some things. Because I want to watch these players after they win and hear like, okay, what's, you know, when it went right, what was it that went right? She dove into her serve and she did say, I thought it was very telling, Jill, she wanted to do this last year, but didn't have any time. So the idea that this top player, and I've talked about it with other guests for the past couple weeks on the show, because I'm fascinated, the number one player in the world finds something that she wants to do better. But she said, look, the serve was something that was always on my mind, but I never really had time to do it. She said she found a tight window in the off season, and it is a testament to her greatness, not just settling with one tournament result. She's clearly got the big picture in mind to do something like this.
Well, that's what champions continue to do, is always find those little things to work on. I mean, you never want to get too settled with how you're playing, even if you feel like you're playing to the best of your ability, because everyone's always trying to improve and get better and to catch up. And that's a sign of a great champion, is never letting that time just be the way it is. You always are looking to improve something, and it could be something so small that makes the biggest difference. And for her, you know, having a little bit of a change on the serve was something that she's been wanting to do. And sometimes for players, you have to do it during the calendar year, because the tennis calendar year is so long and so tournament heavy. That is those small windows that you have to find.
Well, she's won the Sunshine Double before. She's the favorite to win Miami and do it again. Then we got Clay, where we know she's just the best by a mile on that. So we could be looking at another iconic Iga year. Very remarkable stuff there. Also, do want to give credit. I know the final set didn't go well, but Maria Sakkari's run to the Indian Wells final, getting back on track. This partnership with David Witt looks like it is a match made in heaven. He's that chilling, calm influence that I think she needs at time. And she showed real grit and real determination. That match, Jill, against Coco Gauff in the semis, especially after how that second set went down, I don't know that she would have won that match maybe even a couple months ago.
Maybe not. We don't know for sure. But like I mentioned, I do feel like she definitely looked more confident than I've seen in the past, where she's struggled a little bit, had, you know, a few ups and downs. But I liked the way she competed. She looked like she never doubted herself for a moment, even if she, you know, lost a few games in a row. I like that she's kept still going after it. And sometimes it is, you know, needing a fresh voice in your head just to hear something differently. It could be saying the same thing, but in a different way, that where a player clicks and it connects. So it is good to see her. It was great to see her the way she competed, I think.
Yeah, I think that We're looking at Sakkari as somebody that the big tournaments, it hasn't been there. The majors, obviously, it hasn't really been there. But if she can find that confidence, we saw the skill too, like how she was crushing some forehands. The net play was inspiring stuff too. Mm-hmm. Losing to Iga doesn't make you very rare in that sense. So I think she's going to take some positives out of this and then, you know, go into Miami. Because on the other side of it, there's players that have, you know, had letdowns, haven't been able to back up results. She's been consistently a top 10 player. So I think what she did need was a big result to remind her of that.
Yeah, I agree. That always brings confidence when you get good matches in. And sometimes, you know, just getting some wins under your belt, whether you're playing well or not, that can go a long way as well, just being able to fight and gut your way through some matches. But I do feel like you said Iga got better throughout the tournament. I do feel like Sakkari got better throughout the tournament as well. And that's always going to bring some confidence.
So the rest on the women before we switch to the men, Jill, I had two things. One being, I can't remember a match, that quarterfinal that Coco won, where a player won with 17 double faults. I was really in straight sets, I should say. That was the part of it where, on one hand, you're like, what fight? What? Just find a way. That's the name of the game. Just shake hands and be the winner. But that is a lot of double faults, and that's a problem that, unfortunately, she's had in the past that I hope, for her sake, isn't rearing its ugly head again.
No, obviously, sometimes you can have a bad day or struggles like that. I know sometimes she can throw in some double faults. I think the key is to be able to mentally not let that get to you so much if you possibly can. And you're right, just being able to get through some of those matches. And, you know, sometimes you see players immediately go to the practice court and work on something, just a little tweak or something to get that confidence for the next match. But it is sometimes just about getting through those moments because you're not going to play your best the majority of the time.
Uh-huh. She's somebody that has handled losses and setbacks very well, which is a big compliment to her game that a match like that isn't going to stay with her as long as maybe it would someone else. So I think Coco, I mean, she's going to Miami, her home state, not a teenager anymore. There's a real chance here for her to do some damage. The other one was, to put a bow on the women's event, a great run for Marta Kostyuk. I know it didn't end well for her, but this is somebody that we've saw the potential. She's starting to look like a bona fide top 30, maybe top 20. Who knows what the ceiling is, Jill, because she actually has weapons out there too, which is, you know, something to be said. There's a lot of players with weapons on the female tour, but I think what Kostyuk could do is really impressive, and I don't think this is the end for her either.
I've always been a huge fan of her game. I think technically she's very sound, and I also think she's good in all areas of the court. She's not afraid to come forward. She's very solid at the net. So I've always been a huge fan of how she plays, but it was just that little self-belief that she needed to be able to have a big result like she had in Indian Wells. So that was good to see it kind of her be able to bring it together.
Yeah, she's not afraid out there. She's definitely going to fight, and it might be, you know, there might be an internal dialogue. She might say something to the coach, but the level of competition is there. Well,
it's only a kick. A jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
More with Jill Kravis here on Tennis Channel Inside In, talking Indian Wells. The men's side was riveting stuff. Carlos Alcaraz gets back to the winner's circle. He defends his Indian Wells title. There was much made about how he hadn't won a title since Wimbledon, but here he is again. And looking as confident as ever, I went into this week, this tournament, Jill, thinking when I saw some of these matches that this could be his best event. Like, this just suits his game, and I'm doubling down on it because he looks electrifying whenever he plays in Palm Springs, and he brings out his best stuff here. That center match was awesome, and he backed it up with another quality win. Another win going away against Daniil Medvedev.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I think there was some concern before the tournament, right? Because he had that ankle injury that he had in Rio in South America. So everyone was questioning whether he might be 100% to be able to play through the entire tournament. And the first round was a little bit tricky. His first round, which is second round, he went three sets with Arnaldi. And we were wondering, and it's never easy coming back from an injury, especially testing your movement and stuff like that. But he did get better and better as the tournament. And I was courtside for that match against Sinner. It was absolutely incredible. I mean, they're such good guys. They had a laugh together with a couple incredible points that they played. And he just knows how to use that energy so well for him to get back on track when maybe he lost that first set against Sinner, also went down against Medvedev in the beginning in the final, but he somehow finds that way to be able to bring that energy to get him to start playing to the ability he needed to win the tournament. It was incredible to watch.
It's a great point because he's a showman. The crowd loves him, obviously, but there is a skill, and he obviously has it, in knowing when to go to the crowd, when to use the energy, when to get up. You can't do it all the time or the fans are going to be a little exhausted themselves. Yeah. So he knows the big points there, and he knows problem solving. And that was the one area where we thought, okay, like, this guy has a great plan A. It works against everyone. Has he been able to make adjustments at the biggest matches? Well, this was a tournament that answered a lot of those questions because, as you mentioned, lost the first set to Sinner and then was down early against Medvedev. What I really liked about that Sinner match, watching it, Jill, was that when greats in any sport play each other, whether it's tennis or, I mean, we'll say one-on-one sports like boxing or something like that, but the tricks that work against everybody else, right, the stuff that they're good, they don't quite work as well. And so then they have to go deeper into the well. So when you see Sinner play Alcaraz, you know that their game, that's good enough, their shots in any given moment that are good enough to beat 98, 99% of the competition, they're not quite as good to finish everybody off in this match. So they have to dig deeper and find other ways to win, which Alcaraz clearly did.
Well, what's incredible is I couldn't believe when I saw the head-to-head that, because this was the eighth time they played against each other, and I was surprised it was that often already for someone who's just 20 and 22 years of age. So you know they know each other's patterns fairly well. You know what the other one is going to bring across the court. And I think that's such a good rivalry to have, because even though you know that, you're going to have to find a way to lift your level somehow. Yeah, and so I'm excited to watch even more, hopefully, battles between the two, because they're going to push each other to get better and better. And that's going to be exciting.
Yeah, I'm going to butcher it, but I saw like a short phrase summarized against like Alcaraz, or Sinner is the one guy that might be good enough to hit through Alcaraz's unreal athleticism. And Alcaraz is the one guy that could run down some of Sinner's winners. So they have a lot there. And for Sinner, I mean, the streak ends. He'd won, I think, 17 straight to start the year. It's the fifth best since 1990. And you look at the names of who it's in there, it's a joke. But, you know, sometimes losing it, you know, you want to win every match still, right? But it's good to kind of be like, okay, not worrying about this undefeated streak or preserving it. He's been so process-oriented that I think just going back to the well after a loss, especially for the coaches and the team, are going to be a good thing for him. And you know he's going to be receptive to how we bounce back and how he can get better the next time he gets a crack at Carlos.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the kind of mindset that he has. He's always probably, I mean, I felt like off the court after that semifinal loss, he was already kind of analyzing and what he can do better. And, you know, he's going to be right back out there working at it. And he said that after he won the Australian Open as well. He was like, okay, time for the next phase. Like, he had maybe just a little moment to enjoy it. And he was already like ready to improve and get better from that moment on. And that's an incredible mindset to be able to have.
Yeah, he put the trophy in his house. He's like, all right, time to get on the plane and get back to work. This was a great match, and Alcaraz pulling away late. I mean, anyone's going to be pressing in moments when the pressure's on from Carlos. He was miraculous there. And the final against Medvedev, again, figuring out a way to, again, play his best tennis down the stretch. It's hard, though. It's hard for me, too, because every time I see Medvedev play good or bad, I'm just more and more fascinated by it. Whatever happens, he's become, for me, one of the best watches in not just tennis but sports, because regardless of what happens, Jill, and we saw this on the run, he just finds a way to keep going deep into these tournaments. Whether there's an issue with the atmosphere, his opponent across the net, maybe himself, his team, he's going to use that to his advantage. He's going to find a way, and he's going to be in these last couple matches of every tournament, it seems.
Yeah, he's just amazingly consistent. It's hard to find a hole against him because, one, he's so long. I mean, he's 6'6", so every step that Alcaraz takes, Medvedev has to take five less steps than he does. But he's just incredibly consistent, and he just understands the angles of the court so well. He's just such a smart player. So it is tough to consistently have to find a hole against him, and that's what makes him so dangerous.
The match and the moment against Holger was one of the funniest things I've seen. And I'm glad they smoothed it over, I think. But it was, and even the Tommy Paul match. Paul played one of the sets of his career, set one. Medvedev just readjusted, reprogrammed, and got the win at the end. I watched Daniil, and I wonder, there's different ways to skin a cat, is the phrase, but he's found a way that fits his game and fits what he can do. And there's something to be said, Jill, right, about in tennis, playing to your strengths. Medvedev knows his game maybe better than any player on tour, and that's a pretty hefty compliment, but he knows what he's doing out there, and he knows how playing fits him the best.
Well, it's so hard to hit through him, and he can absorb pace so well. So, I mean, even the players that feel like they have weapons in their game, Medvedev moves so well for someone who's so tall.
Yeah.
And he's just able to get so many balls back and place it to a tee. So you have to have the mindset to go out there and be willing to realize that these rallies could be very long, and you're going to have to be aggressive and patient at the same time. I mean, that's not an easy combination to do.
Have you ever had a moment like he had in the first set tiebreak where you're just, say, for the PC version, wondering why you're playing tennis? I like that too, because he's just open about it. He's like, he said after, I say crazy things out there. But definitely helps him. I do feel, you know, I feel like this was a good moment again, sour taste, but the big picture of being one of the last four for Tommy Paul, gets to the Final Four, has a real chance to get to the final. Wasn't able to pull it out, but he's somebody that, look, he's got a real opportunity, not just for the next couple months, Jill, but I think he could be in the mix for top-ranked American. Other people have said that as well. He has athleticism that is otherworldly. That's on a short list, maybe one hand of athletes on the men's tour. What did you see from Tommy Paul this tournament that, you know, you liked and you think he could build on?
Well, one, I think he's always been deceptively fast. I think because the way he moves, I don't think you really notice how quick he is, but if you really pay attention, he's one of the quickest movers out there. But the difference to me, when I saw him in Indian Wells, what, you know, he always is very consistent from the ground. He's pretty solid at the net as well, but he was looking to add that extra aggression, I think, throughout his game in Indian Wells. Even on second serves, he was standing more inside, looking to try and punish the second serve when he had the opportunity. So for me, overall, that added aggressiveness, I think, paid off quite a bit to be able to get to the semis.
I think I agree. And I think the deceptive fast part, for me, there's two types of quickness, right? There's that lateral and vertical quickness. Mm-hmm. I think we've all kind of seen the lateral quickness from him.
Yeah.
But with his hands being as exceptional as they are too, getting to the net, that was, especially in that first set in the Medvedev match, I'm like, wow, he is there and he's putting points away. And Medvedev even said after, that's how you play me. Like, if you're able to redline like that and do that, it's hard for me to do anything. So,
but I think he could get quicker to the net because he was having more of an aggressive stance overall. So I think, you know, if you're standing further back and you're being aggressive, you have to cover way more court to get in. Mm-hmm. But the fact that he was willing to sort of, you know, use that court position a little bit more in an aggressive way helped him quite a bit be able to get up to the net and transition forward.
It was great, and I hope that he builds off of it as well. Indian Wells was a fun tournament. Again, congrats to Carlos and Iga. And then I guess also congrats to the beekeeper who went famous too.
Yeah, I know.
Because that was that was a wild couple hours in Palm Springs.
You know, there were a couple instances. There was that on the court, and then 4 days prior to that, there was a swarm of bees in the player dining, and
really?
Then all of a sudden they congregated to one of the legs of the picnic table. So it happened twice.
So I was at Indian Wells with some family on Sunday, the week before.
I don't remember what day it was.
Yeah, I bring this up because there was a swarm. There was a giant beehive in just the grounds where the fans were walking.
Oh,
I remember,
okay.
Like, we were making comments like, wow, that's a ton of bees. And apparently they never left. So,
yeah.
It's been a weird time, too. I don't know if you saw the Venus match today. There was a cat that got onto the court, too. So the animals are coming
out. I did not see that. There was a snake somewhere as well, like a couple months ago. I don't know. I don't know what's happening.
There's animals. Somebody did something wrong. We're going to have to, you know, beg forgiveness for. Well, before I let you go here, Jill Kravis on Tennis Channel Insight, and wanted to spend a couple minutes on Miami in this transition. The women's draw starting today as we record this. The men starting tomorrow. But you can speak as a former player to this, right? It's a sunshine double. It's a mini season. It's two hardcore tournaments. But as you know, it's so very different playing from one to the next. What is the biggest difference that you can tell people out there that don't know? Okay, it's two hardcore tournaments, but you're going from one drastic condition to the other.
Yeah, it's very different. I mean, Indian Wells conditions are very unique in general because you're in the desert. The air is very dry, so the ball goes through the air pretty quickly. But then once it hits the court, it's very slow off the court. And so in Miami, it was always much more humid. Both can be windy, although I found Miami a little bit more windy consistently across days. Mm. But the humidity is the biggest difference. So that air is just a little bit heavier. The ball doesn't go through the air as quickly. The courts tended to be a little bit quicker. So that there's quite a few different adjustments that you have to make. You know, hitting through the ball a little bit more to get that speed on it was always something that you had to add to your game. And, you know, just getting used to that humidity again can be really difficult.
How old were you the first time you played tennis or meaningful tennis match in the state of Florida?
Well, I went to the University of Florida.
Yeah, I was wondering if it was before then or was it not till college?
I don't think I played a competitive match in Florida before college. I did go to like a camp for like a week, but
I'm getting at the sense of the conditions, right? Like we saw, unfortunately, Arthur Cazot was, you know, fainted in his match. It seems like he's okay, which is good. But These conditions are just brutal.
Yeah.
And I was wondering in terms of a player, like, okay, the adjustment, what it takes to really get acclimated, or if it does take a couple reps, a couple actual matches to be used to playing down there.
Or yeah, you might never get used to it. It's a hard question to answer just because everyone reacts differently to things. I mean, there are a lot of players that are more prone to cramping than others. Mm-hmm. And so it depends on you as the player. There are some players that love playing in the humidity that just doesn't bother them at all. But the biggest thing is obviously hydration. Yeah. I mean, that goes without saying at any tournament, really. And using the ice towels and making sure you have electrolytes and stuff like that. So, and a lot of it happens before you actually walk on the court for the match, like a couple of days leading up to your match. And but you have to figure that out for yourself as an individual and how to maintain that.
That's one of the best things, I think, about the evolution of tennis as like a business and having these teams around them, is that we're getting that side kind of a lot better. There's still, you know, incidents where players will cramp up, but it's good to know that you have, you know, the very best people looking out, and people like yourself that have lived it and know how to give advice. Yeah. Well, you know, the event started today on the women's side. I was looking at some of the results, and someone you mentioned last year, you got the chance to meet too. Peyton Stearns got her first win in her draw there. I really do hope, you know, it didn't end well at Indian Wells, but she gave Sabalenka everything she can handle. And this seems somebody that's got a fight, got a lot of fight inside of her. So I think it's going to keep going.
Yeah. I mean, those are matches that are tough to swallow, I think, because she had 4 match points, something like that, against Sabalenka. But that's where you just got to know, okay, hey, I was there with, you know, the number 2 player in the world. I can hang. I had the opportunity to get through that. But so for her, that's just about how do you handle those moments a little bit better. Yep. But she played it great. Yeah.
Well, I mentioned some of the women I think could do well. Obviously, Iga has won here before, and we'll see Sabalenka's status. But her game speaks for itself. I'm curious to see Elena Rybakina, what her level is after the unfortunate pullout at Indian Wells, because based on a lot of what you were saying about the conditions, I think if she is on, she could do very well here.
I agree. I think she's got the game to do well anywhere. I mean, if she's serving well and she gets that first strike on the ball, I mean, she's one of the most dangerous players there. And I think those conditions would suit her just because the courts are pretty quick, and it'd be tougher to return her serve there than it would be at Indian Wells. So I think she would enjoy playing in those conditions.
Kvitova won last year. She's out another maternity leave. It's just been so many. It's been great. I mean, someone like Wozniacki comes back, it's insane how she's just winning matches off of it. But the big hitters, as you mentioned, have done well. Maybe someone like Haddad Maya can do well. And maybe even somebody, Jill, like Naomi Osaka, who's looked a little better every tournament we've seen her.
Well, I think it's exciting on actually both the women and the men, because I mean, every time we talk about this, I feel like there's so many players that you can throw into the mix and put on the list of who can go deep and who can win the tournament. And to me, that's super exciting. I love this time, and just seeing, you know, still seeing some of the veterans, and then just like you mentioned, Wozniacki, Svitolina coming back as well after being a mom, playing exceptionally well. Yeah. So I think there's a lot of opportunity on both the men and the women.
The tennis couples list is growing too.
And I know.
It's cool to see. And you said Svitolina. I was thinking Monfils, because that Indian Wells was just insane what he was able to do. And there's still moments where if you talk about a showman, he's still probably the best. And
so
he knows exactly when to tap into the crowd and get everything going. Well, Jill, you've been very generous with your time. I really appreciate you coming on the show. Hope to do this again soon. Yeah, it's been a real pleasure. I won't ask you to make any picks or predictions for the season, but I think
we've got it.
Yeah, I know. Everyone gets bombarded. I'm like, no picks. We're good. We're just starting.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
But Jill Kravis, always a pleasure. Thanks for coming on Tennis Channel Inside In.
Thanks, Mitch.
Huge thanks to Jill Kravis for another terrific appearance on Tennis Channel Inside In. Some outstanding analysis of what went down at Indian Wells. And Jill's got us all ready to go for the Miami Open, the second leg of the Sunshine Double. So thank you again to Jill Kravis. Now something different for Tennis Channel Inside In. I'm going to be joined by Robin Duda. She is the co-founder and managing director of Racket X, this world-class festival that's taking place in a couple of days in Miami. March 24th to March 26th, all racket sports under the sun are going to be covered at this outstanding, innovative concept. She's an entrepreneur and an innovator. We discuss how this idea came to be, how RacketX can help bridge the gap between consumers and investors and active participants of all these sports, and how we can all just get along in the racket space, which I think is the message of the day, of the year, what have you. So Robin Duda joins the podcast now. This was a terrific interview, a great conversation with her. I hope you enjoy it. Here is Robin Duda now on Tennis Channel Inside In. All right, now joining us on Tennis Channel Inside In, delighted to have this guest going outside the weekly grind of the tennis world for a special guest on this week's show. Delighted to be talking to this person with many elite skill sets in the world of business and innovation. She founded RDC, an event management firm that bridges the gap between consumers and the companies themselves. She's an event and an award-winning event strategist. She's worked with all the big companies, Spotify, Coca-Cola, IDM. Got to shout out Spotify for hosting this great podcast, of course, too. But the new thing right now is RacketX.
One of my first clients.
Yeah, well, hey, they pay the bills too, so we love Spotify here. But RacketX is the new thing that she is the brainchild, the mastermind behind. It's a racket sports world firm, a convention this week in Miami, 3 days, March 24th to 26th. Literally all the racket sports in the world. I'm delighted to be talking to this person. Her reputation precedes herself. Robin Duda, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me, Mitch. Such nice words.
Yeah, I appreciate this. And when I, you know, was researching you and what this event is, I was very intrigued and excited to hear about it, because we'll get into all the racket sports and where we are right now in the emergence of just how popular everything has gotten in the last couple of years, especially. But your background was an interesting one too. And whether I'm talking to tennis players, analysts, or people outside the bubble that I'm in, I kind of want to get into their backstory first. So if I have this right, so you have Muhlenberg College, Pennsylvania. Are you a native Midwesterner or East Coaster? Is that where this whole story
East
started?
East Coast, born and raised in Northeastern PA. Okay. So if you ever watch The Office, Scranton, I'm from a suburb of a suburb of Scranton.
Okay. So yeah, it started there, and I was looking at your educational background. And what struck me, because again, people deviate from where they study and they find themselves, which is, believe me, I can attest to, but there was a lot of leadership roles. There was a lot of activity. You were one of those people that went to college, and you kind of, and I'm sure you had some fun too, but you went to work. You were, you know, hands-on and everything. Was that something that you kind of discovered, or was that always kind of ingrained in you when you were growing up that you wanted to take
it? It was definitely ingrained in me to be the nobody does it as good as you can, and raise your hand. And, you know, it was also the, be the solution, you know, don't complain. If you want something to change, you got to change it. That type of attitude, which was amazing. I'm a fourth generation entrepreneur now because of it. Also a lot of therapy bills because of it. But, I went to college to play basketball. So this is my, I know I'm a racket sport gal, but I'm also torn, because this is my favorite time of year is March Madness. But I got hurt. It's a long story, but I got hurt when I was in high school, late into my career. All the D1 schools dropped me, and I ended up at Muhlenberg, which was amazing. I was their first recruit my year, and then I quit very soon after getting there, too much to their disappointment, because I just, so much else to do. And I was always the kid who did everything, but that was my opportunity to not go to class and just do extracurricular activities.
Yeah.
One of which was a big event.
Right.
So here we are. Well,
it is very fascinating to me, because everybody has their own path, even within industries, they go on different tracks to get where they end up going. But if there is one thing that I've noticed, and I can speak to this too, it is the people that are very active, that are trying their hands in things, that they're using every hour in the day, I would say, in college, because you could probably speak to this too. There was probably five or six things you did, and maybe two of them were like, oh, well, I probably shouldn't have done this, or I'm glad I signed up, but this isn't for me. But then you discover something that lights the spark, that lights the match, and then could be very vital to your career. You might not even know it at the time.
Oh, it changed my whole life. I mean, I always loved planning my birthday parties as a kid and connecting people. But like basketball was what was going to get me to college. I don't think anyone thought I was going to the WNBA by any means, but that was going to be, you know, my kind of like, that was where my identity kind of lied, amongst other things. That's a bit of an exaggeration, but definitely basketball dominated. And then, you know, I I got involved like my freshman year. The school gave us like 15 or 20 grand to plan like a huge black tie gala. And like, once we worked for an entire semester and then you see something come to life, I mean, I was hooked. I was like, I want to do this for the rest of my life, however I can. It wasn't about the party. It was about connecting people. What made them tick? What made them have fun? How did you get people to interact? And I think that part of the human behavior is so fascinating on engagement and interaction. And that's what I really love about what I do. I was like the co-chair of this event my second semester, my freshman year. I did it all 4 years and was just like, this is it for me. I'm good.
It's a great story. It's fortunate timing too. You were able to experience that early and then, okay, now I'm going to use college to get to this in the professional setting. And you've had, you know, I know you mentioned you're being a fourth generation entrepreneur, but you had a lot of event experience. Looking at your resume and your background, it was event heavy for a very long time. And hearing you tell that story, the creative juices were flowing. Like, what was it about not just planning stuff?
It looks like it was scripted that way, although not.
Yeah. Well, what was it like being, you know, not just the planning side of it, but seeing the event come to life and being there for the good, the bad, the indifferent, the feedback that you would experience.
The war stories.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's nothing like it. You have to have a strong stomach. It's not for the faint of heart. The highs are the highest. The lows are the lowest. Because you're dealing, no one's going to die. We're not saving lives. We're not. But the stress levels of, you have to know so much. I think that's why I've always loved it and never really gotten bored. Every project is different, but like, you have to know a little bit about everything. You have to know how to budget, and you have to know like psychology. You have to understand spatial planning and design. Like, there's so many things. And I think that's the really fun part. But then again, you're getting humans to either interact with ideas, businesses, or other people. And there's a major place for that in the world that I don't think is ever going to go away.
And I know you've mentioned this before. You're a big proponent, and why probably you were in the event space, is the real-time feedback of being able to witness firsthand what is, because I don't think a lot of industries, and I could speak to it too, but a lot of industries don't have that luxury. You can't find out right away, okay, this is good, okay, this is bad.
Well, like for Racket X, which we're launching, for instance, I got 3 days. My product is only alive for 3 days out of the entire year. Mm-hmm. So if you don't maximize those 3 days, you got to wait a whole other year. And we know sentiment changes. As soon as you leave a place, people remember things differently. It either the bad thing became worse, the good thing became better. Like, real-time analysis and emotional monitoring is pretty, I think, very critical for what we do. Because like I said, you get like 3 days and you're only as good as the last event you did.
Do you consider yourself more of like a risk taker professionally? Because again, you know, you had this stellar in the event space and you've kind of stepped out of it and you've taken on some challenges that I think a lot of people on your trek might not have done.
I'm definitely a disruptor. I don't want to call myself that because it seems like I don't know, like you're not supposed to, but I definitely have gone against the grain in a lot of the, which is why I consulted for so long. You know, I saw design as very human-centered, not necessarily revenue-centered. And I think if you design things for humans and people and create an amazing experience and moments and think about not just the big things, but the small things, which is very difficult to do, and I don't do it perfect, but if you think about that, the money follows then, and people believe in that authenticity and that brand. So I worked for some really big companies that are for profit, publicly traded, multi-billion-dollar event organizations, and it's all about shareholder. And again, I'm Racket X, and you know, consulting is my livelihood, of course. But I think that there's a different way that we can design and present things, and it doesn't have to look the way it always did. And I do think that there's a real importance and emphasis that I've tried to put on making it an inclusive environment for everyone, big businesses to small, different types of people from different places and backgrounds. And, you know, again, it's year one, but we're trying really hard to make sure that is at least comes through in our messaging. It's not just about the big sports. No offense to tennis. We love ourselves tennis. But like, also, you know, who we're going to be highlighting, the number one squash player in America. And Olympic hopeful in a couple of years. Like, I think that's a really, that it levels the playing field, both, you know, proverbial and pun intended.
Right. No, and you touched on a lot there. I do want to get into with Racket X. So you started this program, and again, it's 3 days coming up here next week, and a lot going on. Every single racket sport that there is under the sun is highlighted. What was the conception of that project? Because, you know, hindsight's like a lot of things. It seems like a great idea, but you would know, putting it together, very difficult, very challenging. How did you and others conceptualize this?
Yeah, I was lucky enough to have some, there's some investors in the padel space, newer investors who were researching their business for e-commerce and clubs, starting some clubs, and they noticed there was no place to do business across racket sports. And one of them was my co-founder, Marco Giberti, is an investor and was in the event space, heavy on the tech side. And we've known each other for quite some time. And he came to me and just said, we think that there's something here and there's some white space. We feel this investment group that I'm in feels the need for it, but, you know, check it out and kind of let us know. We did our due diligence and we knew it was going to be an uphill battle because a lot of the sports are, kind of like this. But I saw that the common denominator across everything, there were a couple of key themes that I think everyone could learn from, let alone everyone wants to grow, whether you're a player, a maker, you're in racquetball or you're in, you know, squash, it doesn't matter. Everyone's looking to grow. And I feel as though it's our responsibility and our job putting this on is that we present the best opportunities for growth across the board. And that's both listening and learning from people inside the industry, but more than just like a whole bunch of talking heads talking about how great they are. It's how do we hear from people who have already done this, made mistakes and done really great things, and how can we all together learn about that thing, not just talk about our sport?
It certainly does seem like, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but there has been a boom in the last couple of years. And I don't want to say since the pandemic started, but from 2020 on, it seems like more people were using racket sports, whether they're tennis, pickleball, padel, what have you, to be active, to get out. And then a lot of new fans, new recreational players were born. Are you seeing it the same way?
Oh, absolutely. Also, I think, you know, pickleball really picked up during the pandemic. Not that it was birthed out of it, but definitely picked up because it's very accessible. You can play as a family. You can play, a grandfather can play their grandkid. I think that you can just set up a mini court in your driveway. I think it's a very easily accessible sport to the masses. And I think that's why a lot in America has been drawn to it. Because you can do it pretty easy.
More with Robin Duda here on Tennis Channel Inside In, talking Racket X with the founder this week coming up March 24th to 26th in Miami. A lot more to ask you about, you know, this cool concept of getting all the racket sports together. I guess first, why Miami? I mean, I love the Miami Open. You don't have to sell me on it, but why this time in the year? And if there was a plan to set it up with this enormous successful tennis tournament.
Well, you know, when you're launching an event, it's always great to have something that already exists near where you're going. Starting stuff from when we're building something from scratch, from air, it's hard enough to begin with. And the thought process was Miami, Florida in general, is definitely has the highest concentration of clubs across the board, country clubs and racket clubs, tennis clubs together. Padel is huge in Miami, and then the Miami Open was here. So we thought, well, you know, if we're going to do this anywhere, this probably makes the most sense and the highest probability of success in year one. And like, who doesn't want to come to Miami at the end of March when it might still be cold in the Northeast? So that's where we came from. And we're lucky enough to have a Racket X night at the Miami Open on Monday night. And we're probably going to end up with about close to 600 people in a little cheering section, Racket X cheering section, which is, and again, it's going to be people from all the different sports together. And I just think that that's a pretty cool thing that's going to happen. So for us, it was kind of a no-brainer. You know, Miami is, again, representing, you know, all of the, trying to represent as many racket sports as possible, but increasing probability of success.
Yeah, apologies if I missed anything, but you have tennis, pickleball, padel, pop tennis, table tennis, racquetball, squash, and badminton. Is that everything or am I missing?
Cardio tennis.
Okay. I thought I was like 80 to 90% there, but that's just a lot of racket sports. Anything else?
We don't have a squash court, which is unfortunate, or a racquetball wall. Okay. Although I think we're going to have that accomplished for year two.
Okay.
But yeah, everything else, there's a kids day, there's, so USTA is going to do, and of course, lots of different people, all the different courts are going to have a kids day from 10 to 12 on Sunday. From, you know, we want to, again, get as, you know, pipeline and as many kids having a racket in one hand and a paddle in another. And yeah, there's a lot of action going on those nine courts.
Right. And I think the topic of how maybe there could be tensions between the sports and it can be territorial, I think the basic points I want to make are activity at any hobby is great. So it's good to get people out, get people active. It could be like, and I've used the metaphor, it's almost like a buffet, like maybe something's not for you, but there's so many options you can find what your passion is. Maybe it's a couple, maybe it is just one thing. But you touched on this, and this, you know, Robin, the big importance of the Racket X thing, in my opinion, is getting the sponsors, getting people involved, getting investors there. If you create facilities for all, because I think that's where the tension really lies, is not enough facilities for each sport. That's going to be the biggest thing.
Or territory. Yeah, for sure.
So I think that's, and the investor side is huge. If you, you know, and that's why I think ideas like this are great, you know, and pulled off successfully, which I'm sure you're going to do, is that you get more money into all these sports. Everyone can be happy.
That's the thought. And it's, you know, whether you want to admit that you like pickleball or not, you're probably playing with your kid, you know, or you're playing with somebody somewhere on a vacation or whatever. And I just, again, there's room for everyone to grow. I don't think it has to, I understand where some of the tension lies, but I think that that's certainly resolvable. It's all about increasing accessibility of any type of these courts, getting as many people on them and everyone enjoying themselves, but creating pipeline to actually create careers from these sports as well.
Yeah, you're not losing anything by another community growing. So I think that's the biggest thing too.
I don't think so. Yeah.
I mean, look,
we're talking about it.
I can't wait. I'm going to have to see. It's 3 days. And I was looking at the info of what's expected. Over 2,000 people, 100 companies, and 150 speakers as well. So there's a lot. And I know Katrina Adams, who was very high up in the USDA for a long time, will be there. There's a lot of different people speaking. But you're getting a good attendance. What are some of the things, you know, day by day or different speeches that people can hear if they attend this?
Yeah. So from an industry standpoint, obviously, like you mentioned, Katrina, I love Andrew Petcash from Profluence is going to be talking about the death of individual sport, which I think is really interesting about different salaries and that. We have the PTPA, the Professional Tennis Players Association, speaking alongside the NBA Players Association, which I think will be really interesting to talk about player advocacy. And we have, what are some others? There's an AI session, democratization of sport and AI, and how AI can actually further the gap. And if it's not democratized, only the privileged will be able to use AI tools for performance. So I particularly thought that one was super, super interesting. We have, I know it's Tennis Channel, but there's your pickleball sister station.
Yeah, Pickleball TV.
We have for the first, what was that?
Pickleball TV.
We have for the first time ever the MLP, the PPA, and the APP on stage together, along with the USA Pickleball. So that's a first, and they'll be talking about where they think the future of the industry is going. But again, they've never been on the same stage together ever. So that'll be happening. We have, those are from, you know, some highlights, but even there's a main stage theater where those things are going on that are much more, you know, really broad and high level. And then there's a show floor theater where there'll be lots of different, there's some product demos, a little bit more niche on tomorrow's teachers and how to max, you know, some club stuff on clubs, technology, et cetera. So, those are, for me, those are the couple of the ones. Oh, and there's a session, which we have the Miami Heat, the CMO of the Marlins, doing a fan engagement. Which we know across the entire industry, no matter what sport you're in, it's something that keeps people up at night is how do you keep engaging fans? So we're going to hear from the best of the best of the Miami sports teams and what they're doing.
I think coordinating all of it, because you highlighted a lot there, and one of the things is how much potential and how many opportunities there are that exist, but maybe the coordination hasn't been there even within their own sports. This is good to get people under the same roof, learn some stuff too, and go forward. And you're seeing it too. I mean, I could tell how excited you are in talking about this. Do you see yourself kind of in this space for a little bit as now, I guess, a new racket tennis?
I don't think
racket.
I have a choice now.
Into racket sports now as well, too. You're like a solid recreational racket sports player. Is that right?
I think there are varying opinions on that. Okay. Give me another year until I will showcase any skills. As a former athlete, I have a very high expectation of myself. So I will be in a suit the next couple of days. No, I love them all. I have a love hate with tennis. I've taken lessons for a bit. I started when I was older, so it's harder to certainly, I've had a harder time catching up. I just like being outside and being with different people and anything you could be social. I feel like most of them are pretty social, which is why I think that they're awesome.
Well, this has been very exciting learning about this, and I'm not just saying it. This is a great idea, and it's something that is going to...
We didn't pay him, I swear.
No, definitely not. This is going to inform a lot of people. Any other details about Racket X March 24th to 26th people should know about?
Buy your ticket online. Again, for fans, there's definitely or enthusiasts or players, come see some new equipment. You get to see some, get on our courts, play, demo things, see some pro players play. It's a $35 is the price at the door. So definitely come on by. We're excited to, be a part of Miami and hopefully start to make America's Racket Week history in a few short days.
And we'll be on the lookout, too, on Tennis Channel's coverage of the Miami Open on Monday for the Racket X cheering section, too. So
yeah, we better get a woo.
We'll do our best.
Shout out. Who are those crazy people way up in those top seats?
Yeah. If you make enough noise, they might have no choice but to go to it. So I don't know.
I know.
Robin Duda, this has been a blast. Thank you for coming on Tennis Channel Insight and the founder of Racket X coming up in the next week. Always a pleasure talking to a creative mind and someone passionate about racket sports. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Mitch. Really appreciate you.
Thank you to Joe Kravis and Robin Duda for appearing as guests on this week's show. And thank you to each and every one of our listeners. Reminder that you can find Tennis Channel Insight In on all your podcast platforms. So whether you get your podcast from Spotify, Apple, Amazon Music, iHeart, Google, or somewhere else, rest assured, Tennis Channel Insight In can be found on that platform. Just search Tennis Channel Insight In, subscribe to the show, leave a rating or review, and have Tennis Channel Insight In appear on your listening device every Thursday when you wake up. It is that simple. We're back next week to talk Miami Open, the second leg of the Sunshine Double. Same day of the week, every Thursday, same outstanding show, Tennis Channel Insight In. Can't wait to see what happens at the Miami Open. For Robin Duda and Jill Kravis, my name is Mitch Michaels. This was Tennis Channel Insight In. Thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you next week.